This episode brought to you by Own the Gray podcast. Discover how others age with attitude at ownthegray.ca. The best conversations happen when we're having lunch with our friends, especially when one is a healer. Pull up a chair and join us to expand your knowledge and open your mind.
My guest today, Dr. Doug Lucas, is a health optimization physician. He's the founder of his telehealth practice, Optimal Human Health, where he and his team help patients optimize by reviewing genetics, extensive lab work, and functional testing. His six-month program focuses on lifestyle changes, customized supplementation protocols, hormone optimization and replacement, peptide protocols, and medications when needed. Dr. Doug left his role in the traditional healthcare model as an orthopedic surgeon so he could help educate his patients on how to prevent the surgeries he was trained to perform. And welcome, Dr. Doug.
Thank you, Susan. So happy to be here.
My pleasure. Well, I think the obvious question, which I'm sure everyone asks you, is why did you transform your career from traditional allopathic medicine to a more holistic view?
Yeah, this was it was really hard for me, actually, because I really liked what I did. I went into orthopedics because I loved the idea that I could make such a clear change in somebody's life. And that was true. And in practice, it really was there. But what I found is that the vast majority of the patients that I was seeing, they didn't necessarily need my treatment. They needed probably somebody who had my interest now 10 years earlier, and then that all could have been avoided. I had such an interest in nutrition, such an interest in prevention that I would spend so much time talking about that. And really, my patients weren't there for that. So while it was met well by some people, most people looked at me like I was, out of my place. So I realized pretty early on that I had to make a shift because I knew that I wanted to have conversations about how to help people understand, work through the noise, understand what they can actually do to help prevent the services that I was ultimately providing.
Were you doing a lot of knee replacements? Is that where you saw, for instance, obese people that you if treated earlier, could have prevented that type of thing?
Absolutely. Well, I didn't actually do knee replacements in practice because foot and ankle was my subspecialty. So I did some general work, but I left the joint replacement to the joint replacement guys. But really, in the foot and ankle world, it's even more obvious. Because many of my patients would come in. I had a significant diabetic population. And diabetic patients, even more so than obesity, diabetes is a preventable nutrition disease. Shouldn't even call it a disease. It is a preventable nutrition condition. And people would come to me with, end-stage neuropathy where they can't feel their feet, ulcers that could have been prevented. And ultimately, my role was essentially to whittle away at their feet and ultimately, end up taking their leg off. And that really bothered me. Once I learned that so many of these patients were actually following the recommendations that they were given. They were following the traditional recommendations, which are unfortunately not helping them.
So what we're going to do today is dive into your protocols, because it sounds like you've got the best of traditional and functional medicine. So how lucky are your patients? Let's use the demographic of older women. And what I'd like to do for this discussion is do two examples. The first will be an example of a woman. Let's say she's menopausal, who's carrying excess abdominal weight, low energy. I'm going to use two pretty common scenarios, low energy, possibly diabetic or pre-diabetic. And what I would like to do is ask what your course of action would be, your protocol for a patient like that.
So I start pretty much all of my patients' journey with the same thing, which is I have a discussion with them to figure out, okay, what are you actually dealing with? Where do we want to go from here? I know that ultimately we're going to end up in some kind of an optimization program, but I gear each program a little bit differently so that I can understand how we can best serve them during that time. Because 6 months ends up being, unfortunately, a pretty short period of time. So for somebody like you described, I really want to work on their metabolic health. Whether or not they know it, if they're pre-diabetic, they've had brewing metabolic dysfunction for a long time. So I really want to get to the root of that. And that is a lot of the blood work that we'll talk about. you know, looking at things like fasting insulin, talking about the hormonal theories behind obesity and metabolic dysfunction. But then I also want to learn a little bit more. So I look at genetics on every new patient if they haven't already done it and I have it available to me. The genetics and the epigenetics of things like obesity, diabetes are really interesting. They don't actually help change the protocol much, but what they really do help is to identify other areas where this particular patient might have needs that we're not seeing in the labs, because not everything you can find in labs. So the genetics will be another big component to that. And then the functional testing. So adding the things that I look for, particularly with obesity and metabolic dysfunction, would be gut health. The one thing I screen in almost everybody would be gut permeability. We now have the ability to take a look and see, you know, from a simple blood spot test that you do at home, do you have signs that the gut lining, which we could talk more about, but basically the gut lining has increased permeability. Things are getting through that shouldn't. When that happens, it's going to cause a lot of inflammation, really stress the system, and it makes losing weight and balancing hormones in life very difficult. I also pair that then with kind of the lowest hanging fruit from the food intolerance list, which is wheat, because a lot of people, you know, even if they're not eating bread intentionally, they're still getting wheat in their diet because it's so hard to avoid. Knowing whether or not you tolerate that can be really helpful, and that can help, you know, tilt people in the right direction. So that's generally the starting point. And then based on your history, you know, we can adjust that, you know, add more functional testing, add different labs. That same population is a population that I'm very sensitive to bone health in. So if we need to add bone health labs and have that conversation, we can do that in conjunction too.
Okay. You mentioned the word epigenetics. Just in case I have listeners that aren't familiar with that, can you just give me a quick definition?
I'll give you a definition. Well, it's not that quick.
Okay.
So basically, to understand epigenetics, you have to understand that when we talk about the genetic code, we're talking about, you know, the actual underpinning of what makes us a being, right? Our genes. the reality, though, is that the genes from one human to another human, there's actually very little difference between the two. We're about 99.9% the same. Within that 0.1%, there are these two things. One would be mutations, which I'll describe, and the other would be these things called single nucleotide polymorphisms, which is a long series of words, which we can summarize and just say SNPs for short. So mutations are things that we're taught about in medical school, things like cystic fibrosis. Like if you have the gene mutation for cystic fibrosis, you will have the disease cystic fibrosis. They are causative of disease. SNPs, on the other hand, are not causative of disease. They are associated with disease. What that means is that if you have that SNP, doesn't mean that you will develop that disease. So a really common one that people like to talk about is this one called ApoE. So ApoE, if you have the riskier version of it, this is a SNP that can predispose you to cardiovascular disease and dementia. That's a big deal. We want to know about that. But the epigenetics of it means that you can either turn on or turn off those genes. So by epigenetics, we mean, what are you doing around your genome that can help your body to decide to turn on or off those either risk or beneficial genes, because it goes both ways.
Right. And we do that with lifestyle changes, diet, exercise, the whole package, correct?
Yeah, especially nutrition, the things that you're exposing yourself to, stress mitigation, all of those things have an impact on how we're expressing our genes.
Right. How about just the toxins all around us? Environmental toxins, toxins in the water, I mean, you name it, they're everywhere.
Yeah, this is a really tough one. So it's something that I've considered, you know, should we be doing a tox screen in every patient that comes through? And the answer is probably, but it's very expensive. It's cumbersome to do. And then we don't always treat it right out of the gate either. So knowing that you have it doesn't necessarily mean that you need to treat it. And so, yeah, we live in a very toxic environment, no matter where you are. You know, you could be in the most protected, beautiful, serene, rural area. And unfortunately, our world has just been polluted by our activities. And so we do have to recognize that those things are always lurking. Again, I don't typically start there because there are generally so many things that we can pick up early on, things that we can correct. The genetics is actually another interesting look at how our detox system works. And that's why I don't necessarily feel like I need to screen everybody, because people that have a very well-functioning detox system probably don't really need to be detoxed because they're doing it already. It's those of us that don't, that we really need to create, okay, you know, what is your daily or weekly plan to help detox the things that are your environment?
Okay, what are the percentage of people that truly have a wheat intolerance?
I don't know what the actual numbers are. I will tell you that, so the way that it's reported to me through this test that I do, and we've done this on, it has to be hundreds of people at this point, but it's reported to me on a spectrum, and it's sort of, you know, the top third is red or severe, and then moderate, and then green. I've never seen anybody that didn't have some reactivity to some protein in wheat. And it's because wheat has so many reactive proteins in it. Gluten is just one of them. And so, yeah, I've never seen anybody that didn't have something. But the thing is if I just told everybody not to eat wheat, I would be like every other dogmatic person out there who says, don't eat this, it's bad for you. Now, I would rather show you, hey, your immune system is reacting to this. You really need to eliminate this in order to achieve your goals.
Right. Is it the zonulin test that you do to check for permeability?
Gut permeability. Yeah, zonulin, there's four, I think there are four proteins that they're looking for, zonulin, actin, and I want to say there's a third and a fourth, but I think they might be other versions of zonulin and actin.
How does someone develop leaky gut?
So leaky gut's really interesting, and you can develop leaky gut certainly from eating things that you're intolerant to. So like, you know, if you have celiac disease and you eat gluten, you will have massive leaky gut and symptoms as a result of it. But it doesn't necessarily have to be that dramatic. It can also be things that you are kind of intolerant to. And this is where it's really tough to know if you consume a food that you're intolerant to, but you don't feel bad immediately, you don't know. But if you have leaky gut over time, you will develop symptoms, a lot of symptoms in various ways. And so that's where the food part is really tough. But interestingly, two other main areas where leaky gut occurs, one is going to be overgrowth of bacteria. So if your listeners have heard of things like SIBO or SIFO, where bacteria are growing in areas of the colon where they're not supposed to be, they start to get broken down by the body, and those breakdown products from the bacteria actually will cause leaky gut as well. Some of the bacteria themselves can produce toxins that can cause leaky gut. And so it becomes a bacterial problem that you have to treat one way or another. The third way that that happens is actually through stress. So there's been some really interesting studies in patients who have had some unfortunate trauma where they're actually doing biopsies of the gut for other reasons. And they've been able to tell that within a very, very short period of time, if you have a head injury or an acute stressor, you develop leaky gut. And this just demonstrates the clear relationship of the nerves that connect the brain to the gut. And so that's another thing to consider, is that even our, you know, emotional stress or the stress that we have on a day-to-day basis, those stressors can have an impact, even if your nutrition is perfect. Even if your gut microbiome is perfect, just that stress can have that same impact on your gut.
Don't they talk about the gut as being almost a second brain?
Right. Yeah. Well, and I think most people don't know this. I mean, there's a huge percentage. I want to say it's around 80 to 90% of the bulk of your immune system is in your gut.
Yeah.
Because of it's that incredible interface, and your immune system wants to catch things that's in there. So yeah, there's so much happening in your gut that most of it we probably don't recognize.
So a woman comes in and she's not on any hormone replacement medication, and she has some excess abdominal weight. Do you look at a full panel of hormones and potentially talk about bioidentical hormone replacement?
Yeah, absolutely. So I address the metabolic side, kind of like we mentioned, through the blood panel. I want to look at her fasting insulin. I want to look at her A1C, which is glucose over time, and fasting glucose and all of that. Sometimes we'll play around with the hormones, adiponeptin and lectin, kind of depending on what their history is. But I want to know what's going on there. But we always address the hormones. And so, you know, if the patient is postmenopausal and they're not on hormone replacement, I do test their hormones, but I almost don't need to, because we know that they're essentially zero. And then, yes, I have a conversation with every woman about bioidentical hormone replacement, because I think most women, based on my experience, most women have not had a good discussion about it. They make a decision whether or not to consider it or not based off of whatever, you know, they're surrounded by, you know, somebody that's had a bad experience or a good experience or social media or the news or whatever. And so they haven't had a real discussion of what it means, what it can do. And it's not just about menopause symptom relief, although that's not to say that that's insignificant, because it is, but the other things that it can do. So yeah, I definitely have that conversation every time.
Are you pro hormone replacement?
I feel it out initially and see what their gut says, you know, and if they have a strong opinion to say, you know, I don't want to do it. I want to age gracefully and naturally. I don't want to take hormones, then you just kind of back off. But if they're open to the conversation to say, you know, yes, let's look at your history. Do you have a personal history of breast cancer or blood clot, family history, you know, immediate family member of breast cancer or blood clot? And if the answer is yes, it doesn't necessarily mean you aren't a candidate. It just means we need to learn more information. And then if it's all clear, then we have the discussion to say, look, hormones are very good for symptom relief of menopause. It can wipe them out and they can be so debilitating. In addition to that, it also has a role to play in your bone health, a role to play in maintaining your muscle mass, maintaining your skin integrity, maintaining the pliability of the vasculature and cardiovascular system, and help with disease prevention, potentially helping with dementia prevention. And in fact, a lot of studies, no, I shouldn't say a lot, but several studies looking at bioidentical hormone versus traditional hormone replacement, showing that estriol over estradiol can actually reduce the risk of breast cancer. So it is, you know, it is just a very interesting, it's an interesting field, and there's a lot of misinformation. And so, yeah, I spend a lot of time going through that.
A woman comes in who says, Dr. Lucas, you know, I've tried to lose this abdominal weight and I'm able to lose it, but it always comes back. Why is it so hard for people, not just women, but why is it so hard for people to keep the weight off?
Yeah, we are in a very interesting time with weight loss, you know, because the rates keep going up and up, and it's not because people aren't trying hard. So there are so many factors working against us. You know, our bodies have been trying really hard for thousands of years to be able to maintain weight. So we have all these tools to help us maintain weight. And now we're in a position where we have abundant, I don't want to call it nutrition, we'll call it abundant calories. We have the stress associated with our current environment. We have industries that have latched on to our addictive tendencies as humans. So we are just being assaulted from every angle, whether it be, you know, mental, social, emotional stress, whether it be addictive food or addictive gum or addictive, you know, whatever, the behaviors, the social things around the cakes and the fact that, like, I get made fun of because I never bring donuts into my staff. Like, so many things that it just, they add up, you know? And so people, I guess most people that I talk to don't wonder why they can't keep weight off, but I have a very special population of patient. And so I see it all the time though, and people do get frustrated, and it's because there are just so many different things working against them. The fact that she's lost weight before, if you talk about the specific patient, right. There are so many ways to lose weight. Some of them are actually healthy. Most of them are not. And again, driven by pharmaceuticals, driven by, you know, schemes, driven by ways that are going to get you to lose weight, but it's going to be temporary. And you are just, you know, you're going to gain your weight back, or at least you should know if you did the research on it. And so what I mean by that are things that are not driven by behavior change. If you're going to lose weight, you have to change behaviors around food. You have to have an understanding of food. Susan, I don't think we talked about this, but my wife actually runs a weight loss program. And so she's a PhD and a registered dietitian. And one of her principles around losing weight is that 90% of the weight loss journey is in the mind. If you don't address the behaviors around food, recognizing that for the vast majority of people struggling with weight, that really they're dealing with food addiction. People don't like to talk about that. But if you don't address those things, your weight's always going to come back. Always. I end up talking about that a fair amount. But yeah, it's frustrating for both women and for men, but for different reasons.
So you do a lot of counseling then?
We do. Yeah. So I you know, I've gone back and forth with how much time for me to spend with the patient, because the more time I spend with my patients, the more expensive the program gets. And not everybody wants to hear me talk for that long. So I use a coach that I have one coach in my program I really like. Her name's Bretta. She has a master's in nutrition. She's a registered dietitian, and she gets this. Part of the weight loss journey, and more importantly, the maintenance journey, is a continued accountability. Once you are, you know, once you get to goal, then you can't let off the gas. We are always either growing or we're dying. We are never in maintenance mode. There is no maintenance mode. It doesn't exist.
Right. So the example of the woman, then the other woman who's healthy,
yeah,
and is coming to see you because she wants to prevent possible future illness and live a higher quality of life, perhaps even increase her longevity. Is it basically a similar protocol? You do all the same tests?
Probably, unless you had some unique scenarios, which we'd want to change one way or the other. But yeah, we would probably start with the same blood panel, get the genetics, probably the same functional panel, again, depending on her history. We would start there. And I'll say that whenever I see somebody who looks like they're quote unquote healthy, there's usually so much happening under the hood. I know, and that's why I love what I do, because we uncover all these things. Never had somebody go through and have a squeaky clean panel. It's never happened.
That's scary in some ways. I mean, you know, I know when you do the cortisol panel, the stress, I'm sure that you must see some really interesting results on that, because people can hide that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Well, and I mean, more importantly, and I think we actually kind of glossed over that. We got stuck talking about the gut. But when we do the adrenal, we do what's called a diurnal cortisol. So it's a saliva test, and it gives you 4 points throughout the day. And it tells you sort of the curve of what your adrenal glands are doing and how you're responding to the stress of the day. It is so telling and important, because depending on where you are on you know, having a bigger curve or a lack of a curve really will change how we approach the patient. So yeah, looking at the cortisol, and again, you know, how often do I see a normal cortisol curve? It happens, but it's really rare.
I'm curious about these peptide protocols that you talk about. What's a peptide to begin with? And what would a peptide protocol include?
Yeah, so peptides, just to take the big picture perspective, peptides are these really interesting molecules. They're essentially short proteins. So a protein made up of amino acids, a peptide is just a short protein. I forget what the actual threshold of amino acids is, but it's short. And what's interesting about peptides is that they are basically signaling molecules. So they're given either as a capsule or as an injection, most frequently as an injection. And they basically tell your body to do something, not unlike a pharmaceutical or a drug, or like potentially some nutraceuticals, depending on what they are. And those are supplements. What makes peptides unique in their own space is that the FDA generally doesn't regulate them, because they're not made by pharmaceutical companies. So they are prescription products, or at least they should be, and I'll touch on that. They are generally prescription products. A physician has to prescribe them, but the FDA does not regulate those coming out of compounding pharmacies, because they're not made by drug companies. So it's this kind of gray area that the FDA doesn't like. So they would like to have more control over this area, but again, they're limited because of what's happening from the drug company perspective. I say they should be prescription, because if you were to Google the name of some of these peptides we're about to talk about, you could probably find a place to get them. Don't do that, because if it's not coming from a well-qualified compounding pharmacy, you don't know what you're getting, and you do not want to inject something that you don't know what it is into your body, or take a capsule for that matter. Right. The gut gets pretty good at taking stuff out that isn't good for you, but it's not perfect. So yeah, so definitely get them from a doctor who knows what they're doing with peptides and has a good compounding pharmacy that they trust.
So what are they used for?
Yeah, so I think the most common peptide that I use in my practice would be one called BPC-157. So BPC stands for Body Protective Compound. And there are kind of two forms of it, but the one I use most common is it's in my protocol to treat leaky gut. So we get that test that we talked about. People have gut permeability. BPC has good evidence behind it to support the idea that it can heal leaky gut. These are human studies. It shows that it can help heal the vasculature and heal leaky gut. What's cool about that is that a lot of peptides don't have good human research, and this one really does. So I'm pretty confident using this one. It's a capsule. I see incredible improvements, and it only takes about 30 days. Whereas if you were to do this through a kind of a nutraceutical or supplement approach, it can take a lot longer. Yeah.
Are these peptides used as an anti-aging protocol as well?
Oh, for sure. So there are a lot of them. I think, you know, the pharmacy that I have a couple of different pharmacies, but you know, they stock or make probably a few dozen. There are a few, you know, there are hundreds of them out there. I only use ones that I'm confident that have reasonable human studies behind them. But yes, absolutely, could be used for anti-aging. BPC oral, people could take it chronically. That's not really what I use it for. For anti-aging, there's some other things that we could talk about.
Okay. Do you do ozone therapy in your clinic?
So we're all telehealth at this point. So now I don't do ozone. I think it's really interesting. I think the literature is certainly supportive of it, but I currently don't do it.
Do you recommend NAD boosters?
Yeah, so the NAD research is, I will call it compelling. So I take NMN, I used to take NR, which is, right. Listeners that aren't that familiar, NMN and NR are supplements that are supposed to increase intracellular NAD through an oral capsule. I think that's probably the right way to do it. I think people that are doing IV NAD probably are not getting what they think they're getting, and potentially even harming themselves doing it. So the research, I don't know, like I said, it's compelling. It's definitely not clear, but I don't think there's a lot of downside, particularly to NMN or NR. So I also take metformin as a longevity agent for myself. And for my own personal history is that I have a lot of obesity in my family, and we have just elevated fasting glucose. Everyone in my family has elevated glucose over 100. My glucose fasting, even after a 72-hour fast, is still 115, 118. Yeah. And we want it to be down around 80. Right. So for me, taking something like metformin, which knocks it down into the 80s, makes sense. Metformin, there's some question about the mitochondrial toxicity of it, which is part of what it does. That's the reason why right. we take it. But also for someone like my wife, for example, so one of her goals is to layer on some more muscle. She's lost a lot of muscle right. in her right. early adulthood as a result of a number of things. And so for her, we want her to hypertrophy and strength train. Right. Right. And metformin could actually get in the way of that.
Yeah, it does. How about berberine? Do you recommend berberine instead of
metformin? I used to be real hot on berberine, and then I've kind of backed off a little bit. I saw some research that showed that it maybe wasn't as effective as I thought. And really what's happened in my practice is I've kind of gone away from using berberine to using more metformin. And so I think I was more afraid of metformin early on in practice, and I've gotten a little more bold in prescribing it just because the literature, more literature, more acceptance, and why not use something that is really going to bring down glucose?
A few more questions of the hundreds that I could ask you. Three examples of lifestyle tweaks for older women, but the main one would be to keep blood sugar stable. Just a huge problem as you age.
It's funny. I don't know that it used to be a huge problem, but it definitely is now. Yeah. And I don't know, maybe it's because of the exposure to processed foods, or maybe it was the low fat craze of the 80s that killed everybody's mentality. I don't know what it was. Maybe it's toxicity. I have no idea. But yeah, I just see, the epidemic of carbohydrate intolerance. And, when we used to be able to tolerate more of the carbohydrates around us, it just doesn't seem to be true anymore. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think knowing your numbers, making sure that your A1C is low, your fasting glucose isn't creeping up, and that your fasting insulin stays low. I think that probably would be, I don't know that it'd be number one, but it's got to be close.
Okay. Do you recommend intermittent fasting?
I do, although I find that particularly premenopausal women struggle if they have a lot of hormonal shift around their cycles. For postmenopausal women, probably better tolerated. My concern with intermittent fasting for people that take it very seriously is, are they getting enough nutrition in the feeding window? And particularly, my patients that are postmenopausal that are struggling with sarcopenia or losing muscle right. mass, I want them to get enough protein in. And if they have a short feeding window, that becomes right. a challenge.
How about animal protein? Are you pro or con?
I'm very pro. I'm very passionate about it, like I guess everybody is around their feelings on animals. But my feeling is this, which is, again, going back to why are we all so darn carbohydrate intolerant? when you look at getting enough protein from plant sources of protein, it's hard not to overeat carbohydrates just in those protein sources. So then you're kind of left in the cold on that diet approach. So when I see people that are eating an exclusively plant-based diet, they're struggling to get the nutrients in that they need, struggling to get the protein in that they need. Also tending to fall into this trap, which is eating highly processed foods, which we try to avoid. That's not why they went vegan or vegetarian in the first place, is to eat highly processed foods. But you kind of fall into this trap because you're struggling to meet your nutrient needs. Yeah. So I find that, yes, I could talk for a long time about the ethics and the industry around agriculture. And I'll just say the summary is there is a way to do it where it is both beneficial for the animals, can provide them with wonderful lives. Actually, I was just talking to a patient about a regenerative agricultural farm that's right down the street from me. They do such an incredible job. You know, they have a summer camp. My kids go there. I buy meat from there whenever I can. I see their animals. I know their animals. I see their chickens. They're out. Like, they are having the time of their life, very well cared for. The kids love them, play with them. And then they're processed in a way that, you know, isn't stressful for them. And so I think there is a way that we can do it and we can have good quality protein. The other side of that is that if you think that we can grow enough plants without animals to feed the population, you're wrong, because we need animals to put the carbon dioxide and the nitrogen back into the soil. Without it, we're reliant on fertilizers, which is killing our topsoil. So, you know, there are definitely two sides to that conversation, but I think ultimately we have to have animals in the system somehow. Whether or not you choose to eat them is up to you. Now, as my patient, I'm going to tell you that the amino acid profile in animal protein is much better recognized and utilized by humans. So if you want to optimize your health, take all that other stuff out of the equation, you should still eat animal protein.
There's so much information overload out there. I think it's created a very poor relationship to food in general that people have. You know,
people feel guilty.
Right? Yeah.
Like, I feel guilty about eating this, and then I feel guilty about eating this. And then you spend all day just feeling guilty about, you know, consuming. And it's like, no, like, we need to eat something. And if it's 3D printed, that doesn't make it any less bad. You know, now we have to worry about the energy that it took to 3D print this thing, you know? So we have to recognize that we have a relationship with the earth. We have a relationship with the animals around us, and we just need to respect that and be grateful for it.
I read one of your blogs on alkalizing water, and that was very well written. Maybe you can just quickly summarize it, and then I just have one more question.
Yeah, so I wrote that. Trying to think what the big stimulus was. I've had a lot of patients who are on drugs called PPIs, and this goes actually back to my bone health people. So a lot of patients come to me on drugs they're called PPIs or proton pump inhibitors, and they're for acid reflux. They are massively overprescribed, and people shouldn't take them for longer than 7 days unless they have certain conditions, which are pretty rare. Yet people are on them. They're over the counter. They don't know this because, you know, nobody reads the back of that box. And so the whole purpose of a PPI is to reduce stomach acid. And then I get patients that say, well, you know, if an alkaline diet is good, and if, you know, this alkaline water is good, then taking this PPI should also be good. Okay, that kind of works in theory, except that if you look at the literature on PPIs, there is literally a causative, not even an association. There is a causal, take a PPI and develop bad stomach infections. Take a PPI and you have worsening bone quality. Take a PPI and you can't absorb calcium. And so it's a big deal if you completely extinguish stomach acid, because the stomach is supposed to have a pH of 1. It is supposed to be very acidic. That's how it works. And it's not just calcium. There are a lot of other things that can't be absorbed if you're on a PPI. So then that got me thinking about the alkaline water. How much does it actually affect the stomach pH? And the answer is actually significantly. And so if you're gurgling down, you know, essentially high pH or alkaline water all day, it's like taking a minimally effective PPI. And there are some potential benefits, meaning that it can reduce calcium excretion, and in theory could protect you from fracture, but you're also then not absorbing calcium and you're not being able to break down protein. And so, you know, there's the flip side, right? And then unfortunately the same vocal minority that points out all the potential bad things about agriculture will also take that data to say, well, the foods that are acid forming are animal products. Therefore, alkaline diet is good. You should cut out animal products so that you can live a more alkaline life. But also the counter to that is also true, which is, you know, fruits and vegetables are alkaline, and you can alkalize your diet by adding fruits and vegetables to your diet, which I think that you should do, but you don't have to necessarily take away the animal products. You just add more alkaline to it, which, you know, it's funny, like you put that together and you say, okay, so wait, you're telling me that I should eat animal products and vegetables and fruit. Oh, wait, that's actually how we used to eat, you know, back before we started making a big deal out of all this stuff.
Exactly. It's crazy. All right. If you were on a desert island, what would be the one supplement you would absolutely want to have with you?
Oh, man. Can I say, I shouldn't even say this. If I were on a desert island, your audience can't see me. I'm very fair skinned, blonde hair, if you can even see my hair. So I would almost say like sunscreen, although I don't like wearing sunscreen. But I fear like being out in the sun for too long. I'm a big advocate for sun exposure. But let me answer that for real. So gosh, if I could whittle my bucket down to one, that is a really tough one. I would say probably, I was going to say vitamin D, but if I'm getting sun exposure all day long, maybe I don't need it. And that's even a maybe.
Okay, maybe not a desert island. That's a tough one.
Okay.
There's one you couldn't do,
What's my fave? I would honestly probably go with my longevity stuff right now, because I know that I'm getting, you know, I eat a pretty darn good diet full of all the things we just talked about, as well as organ meat. So I know that micronutrient wise, I'm probably doing pretty well.
Yeah.
So I would say probably the longevity, you know, the NMN and NAD precursors, because I'm going to live on that island for a long time.
Do you recommend astaxanthin?
You know, it's a new one for me. I've done a little bit of research on it. It hasn't hit my list yet. I'll put it that way. But it does have some interesting human studies, so it is on my to be rolled out list.
Mm-hmm. It apparently can help prevent sunburn. You might want to check it out.
Yeah, I need some.
Right, but the sun, we need it for natural vitamin D.
You do, yeah. Yeah, and especially the circadian component of it. So I do my best to get out, you know, 20 minutes after I get up in the morning, my whole morning routine, make sure that I get 20 minutes of exposure, and, you know, before I sit behind my UV, you know, protected windows, and then I'm inside all day. And then same thing in the evening, you know, that evening walk, walking the dogs after the kids are down, so that your brain and your eyes can see the sun going down, is really important for circadian rhythm.
Yeah. And isn't that a nice time to walk the dog, though?
It sure is. Yeah.
I love it too. Where can my listeners find you, Dr. Doug?
Yeah. So the best place to find us is on our website, and that's optimalhumanhealth.com. And then that's where we have the blogs that you mentioned, information about our programs, and you can reach out to us. Our email is right on there as well.
This has been really interesting. I really want to thank you for chatting with me.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Susan. This has been fun.
My pleasure.
Thanks so much for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe, give us a 5-star review, and share it with your friends. And join us next time for Lunch with a Healer. Your thoughts with us. Your comments, questions, and suggestions are all welcome. Go to speakpipe.com/lunchwithahealer and record your message. Try it out today.